is December 4th, 1994. This is the Alaska Oral Histories Project tape. My name is Spencer Schaefer. I am interviewing Jacques Bunting. Okay, first question. Would you tell me a little bit about where you were born and grew up, and a little bit about your parents?
Well, I was born and raised in a little town in Easton, Pennsylvania, in 1932. My father was a mill worker. My mother was a housewife. My mother died when I was 7 from tuberculosis. And I grew up mostly with my dad and my brother and 2 sisters. And after that, I joined the Navy in 1950. And my dad died in 1957.
Why did you join the Navy?
I think I joined the Navy because my brother was in the Navy during World War II, and he felt that that would be a good career for me. So I did join and served 22 years, got out as a senior chief in 1972. And my brother, on the other hand, did about 14 years, and then he got out because he decided he didn't want to stay in the Navy. So he passed on in 1988, I believe, but after I had been in the Navy and was pretty well successful. But I enjoyed the Navy. I thought it was a good career, and I learned a lot, and I went to a lot of places and met a lot of good people, and probably one of the reasons I'm here in Kodiak.
Were you interested in aviation and flying before you joined the Navy?
Well, yes. I took my first flight in a little Cub back in 1948 with an instructor at Braden Field in Pennsylvania, and I really liked even the first flight, but the problem back then was money. Nobody had the money to take lessons unless you worked around the airport. You couldn't go to school and work around the airport too. So when I did get in the Navy, I volunteered for, I should say, signed up for the NAVCADS, which was the Navy cadet program leading to flight training. And that went well for about a year, and I thought everything was going well, and I would go to Pensacola and become a pilot and all this. And then an untimely accident with an instructor, we folded a gear on landing, sort of ended that. So I never flew again until, in the 60s, till I was able to get to a place where they had a flying club, and I was able to fly in and get all my certificates.
Were you one of the flying chiefs?
No, I wasn't. I was a chief when I was flying the small aircraft, but I wasn't a flying chief. People like Lou Drum got into that flying program back in the 40s when they took a lot of the enlisted people and trained them to be pilots and became APs, as they called it, aviation pilot. They wore wings, except they weren't a commissioned officer. They were enlisted.
How did you become to be in Kodiak? Had you been here before, or did you request Kodiak, or did you just get shipped here?
Well, I came here from Vietnam to the Admiral Staff. My tour with the Seabees was slowly coming to an end. We were in country at the time, and I fell into the transfer slot, and they offered me Kodiak, and I thought, I didn't know where it was, but I decided it was a good place to be. And it would be a place where I could bring my family. So we came here in 69 and stayed till 70, I guess. No, 66. We got here in 66, stayed till 69. I got transferred to the submarine school in New London. I went there. I had made senior chief by then, and I retired out of New London in 72. And then we came back to Kodiak because we really liked the old small town community type living. People were friendly. Just a million things going here. We didn't have a big drug problem at the time. We didn't have any other problems. And as a result, it turned out to be a good place for the children to be raised.
How have you been involved in the aviation field since you've been here? I know you were involved in the flying club on the base, and I think you started the Brown School at the community college, didn't you?
Well, yes, I did. I After I came back here, I got some more of my ratings, became a flight instructor and all that. And I did the ground school at the college because Paul Bucher was gone by that time, and he had volunteered to do it, and they had nobody to do it, and they called me and said, would you teach the ground school? And I said, well, yes, I could. And I did that. I did that for about 10 or 12 years. I was with the Flying Club. I did some instructing for them. Before that, I was with Kodiak Western Airlines, and I flew for them for a number of years. Generally, my last year since I retired in all aviation, I became a pilot examiner for the Federal Aviation Administration. I became a written test examiner for the FAA. And all this worked well until I had that thing called a heart attack and heart surgery. And as a result, I don't fly anymore, but I still stay active in the aviation community as far as ground instructing and with the Flying Club, helping them out. I just don't fly anymore because of the physical limitations at this point.
So when you worked for Kodiak Western, were you what they are called a bush pilot?
Well, they call them that, and sometimes you really believe that's the truth, because I flew out of mostly King Salmon, Dillingham, that area, and it's the bush, strictly. Little airstrips in the middle of nowhere, and little villages in the middle of nowhere. But overall, real friendly people. If you had a problem, everybody in the village would help you. And I think that's why I enjoyed flying out there. Everybody stuck together, and it just seemed that if you did have a problem, everybody in the village would come out and help. It's by the same token, we take little letters to town for the village people that say needed a stamp or they needed a money order or something, and there was no charge for that. They gave us the money. We did it for them. If they had 2 cents left, we put it in an envelope and took it back the next week. And they were real happy with that. And as a result, it was a nice community. I remember trying to get off one night when it was spring break up, and the mud just kept coating the wings. And every time I'd make the run, I couldn't get off. And I'd get back, and these people all come out, and we're taking their shirts off and wiping the mud off and off the wings and everything. And finally, about 3 hours into this, I got airborne. But I learned from then on, you should have had a cup of coffee and waited for the night breeze to come in there and harden everything up again. But that's the kind of people, and that's why I enjoyed flying in that area. It's rewarding.
What changes or progress has there been in the area of flying in Kodiak since you've been here?
Well, I think it's improved. We have some major air carriers in here now. Certainly the equipment's improved. We have an FAA tower, qualified people up there. We have more scheduled air service out of Kodiak because it's really a transient town. And I think overall we've done real well. I don't think as aviation, like anything else, there's a certain amount of safety problems or accidents that occur. We've had ours. I don't think it's really put us backwards in the deal. If anything, we've learned something out of it. The only sad thing is we've lost some good people. But the ones that are left are going to have to continue. And it's tough comparing aviation in Kodiak to, say, the lower 48. The weather here is not conducive to flying every day, that's for sure. As you notice, we're sitting here today with the snow blowing and the wind howling, and still people are flying. But I think we have done well in Kodiak as a flying community and our airport improvements, safety-wise.
Does this airport have the capabilities of just flying in on instruments, or do you have to fly in visually?
No, we have instruments. We have the ILS system, which is the instrument landing system on the main runway here. And we have the VOR, which is the Omni range. And we have what we call an NDB, which is, there's not too many left, but we have one of them. It's another type of approach. But we have 3 to 4 different approaches we can make it here. And today's a good example. With all this snow blowing and wind howling, there are still getting in on minimums on these approaches, and every flight today has got in.
Do you see any particular direction or any major changes as far as the aviation field is concerned, either in Kodiak or throughout the state of Alaska?
Well, I think all over it's going to change. A couple of recent accidents we've had with some new type aircraft have really sort of got the aviation community to wake up a little bit. You know, we're still fighting. You get a brand new airplane and you say, this airplane is flawless. And then you get a spoiler in a wing that, you know, slows, disturbs the airflow, to inadvertently come out of one side and the plane rolls over. We haven't solved that problem yet. We've gotten so much technology and we don't have the problem solved. The recent accidents we have proved that. You know, at one time we said no electronic devices in any aircraft for the flight. Now we have laptop computers all over the aircraft, people working on their business, and we're still having accidents. And I'm sort of getting curious as whether these low wattage computers are still causing us problems. I personally like to ban them. Well, that's my own opinion. And another thing in aircraft, when you have an accident, there's so much junk inside the airplane. You know, we're carrying on baggage, as you've probably seen at the airport, suitcase at a time. And if I had my way, we'd go back to the one piece of luggage, and it has to fit in a certain size container under the seat. So all that contributes to accidents. And if you survive the accident, you might get killed by a suitcase. That's really what it comes down to. And I'd like to clean that up. I like to make the inside of that airplane clean and get rid of all these electronic devices, which I suspiciously think are causing some problems, because they have an electrical path, and an electrical current is what these particular items on the aircraft depend on. So who's to say that a computer here doesn't kick off a sensor and a spoiler? That's my personal opinion. Nobody's really looked into it yet. They're sort of avoiding it, but that's, you know, that's my opinion about it. I think we have to clean the airplane up, and we have to maybe get some other systems that aren't so much electrical current and little motors and stuff, that something we could, if we have to, manually do it if we had to. We can't do wing spoilers that way, but at least have a double check before you start to deploy one that it's actually working and the other one's working on the same, on each side, so that the aircraft remains in a level place. But you know, the last American Eagle rolled over and that was all they wrote. Now they suspect that there was an engine reverser went bad. And all this is electronics and more electrical devices that contribute to an overall pattern of they all have to work. And one of them doesn't work, you're in trouble when you roll over at that altitude and can't correct the roll and, you know, go towards Earth at 300 miles an hour straight down. It doesn't wake anybody up yet.
So do you think technology is actually going past the capabilities of a human pilot?
I don't think they're going past them. I think they're getting to rely on them too much. I'd like to see a little more checks and safety checks on all these systems they're using. And what I'm saying is that if you punch a button on the dash and it says this will do this, and it only does it on one side, then we don't have a safety measure built in there. In other words, if we're going to punch a button and that spoiler comes out and that one doesn't, we haven't done anything to make the safety 100%. All we've done is add another link that's going to fail. So we got to do something else. Maybe there's a certain speed they should deploy at, or something else that would be a little bit easier than all these massive buttons. I don't know if you've been in a big airplane lately, but it's like science fiction in there. And I could sit there and understand what they're doing, but the average person looks in there and it's just a bunch of lights and they don't really understand it. And I think it's hurting us, because we become complacent in what is going to happen. We say, okay, if I put this instrument bug here for my airspeed, that will remind me never to exceed that. what we do. It's clearly marked when we're doing the approach. Oops, I'm going too fast. We have another button that says, at this point, press button B. And if we don't see what button B does or how it occurs, it's no good. We've got to get something that's a little bit more, how should we say it, mind testing of the pilot, along with an ease of the approach, too, to get down to where we're supposed to get down. I just think that we're getting too complicated with electronics, and it gives us too many more little avenues for error. I think we got to clean that outfit up a little bit. That's my personal opinion. But I think it's becoming too complex with the other duties the pilot has, even though you have a pilot and co-pilot. And as you know, the co-pilot's only sitting there because he wants to be a captain. And so you say, well, you fly this leg of the plane. And that's his job. He flies that leg of the plane. The captain sits there and watches. But I think it has to be a joint effort between the two of them at all times. Not only for the beginning checklist, but for the ending checklist, where they can sit there and communicate. And if the co-pilot sees something, don't be afraid of, how would you say it, the sternness of the captain for saying, don't bother me, son, I know what I'm doing. What we want to do is get that guy to put his finger over there and point and say, I think we're exceeding, captain. And the captain should say, yes, we are, and correct for it. It shouldn't be a case of sit over there and be quiet. I don't think so. I think it ought to be a joint effort. And a lot of airliners it is, but a lot of it isn't.
What do you think is the leading cause of plane accidents in Kodiak?
Well, here, we're talking weather. We're talking mechanical failures at times, but we're talking weather. Over the accidents we've had over the years, I'm going to go back a ways. Paul Bucher, when he went down, although the weather was a little marginal, we felt in his case that the problem became physical, that he had a physical problem because of the way the plane went in. In the case of the airplane that went down at Menascabeira, the Grumman, that was a case of weather. And I think weather is probably one of the biggest factors, because you don't usually have a crew member pass out or this or that. It's usually a weather problem. Glassy water, fog down, water calm. It doesn't tell you where the horizon is, or much less tell you where the clouds are. But weather-related seems to be, in my mind, still the biggest problem. That we're, there's an old thing that they, people are invincible, that they can go on in this weather, just like looking out here. All we're seeing is snowing and blowing. Now, if I didn't know where the tower was, I'd be in a sad state, but I can look right over here and say, yes, there's a tower, because I know where it is. But a pilot out there in the weather, if you're in a place where you're not familiar with, doesn't know where anything is. And when he sits down there in that water thinking it's still 100 feet under and it happens to be a foot when he cuts the power, that's where the accidents start. So I don't think you're going to find a lot of medical problems with people killing themselves. It's going to be weather related. And then I guess next would be equipment failure, as far as the engines, engine quitting, or, as you know, the worst time for an engine to quit is right after takeoff, when you're right at gross weight and taking off and everything's running good, and you're in a float plane and you just break the surface of the water and the weather just a little bad, and the engine quits. And you have virtually no escape except to try to set it back down if you're not fighting the same problem of what was ahead of me, a hill. Geez, have I cleared the hill?
Testing for takeoff. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So is it a problem then when you have a condition like glassy water and fog? Wouldn't the pilot rely on instruments then to find out his altitude rather than visual?
Yeah. We fly a lot of float planes here. And the problem with the instruments is, what it tells you is how fast you're going down, if that's what you're doing, and what our airspeed is, But we're not carrying radar. Unless we remember there's no hills in front of us, there could be one. But the biggest problem with glassy water is, and it usually occurs when you lose the engine, in other words, the engine fails, is you're coming down at a certain glide ratio, and you have to maintain that, because if you don't, you're going to hit the water too hard. And that's what where the problem starts. So if you take off, and 100 feet in the air, the engine quits, you have to transition to a glide with a minimum descent rate to get back on that water. And if you don't, you're going to go in pretty hard. So you compound that problem by saying, having a larger aircraft, a Beaver on floats. And when you do that, what happens? You have a heavier airplane, you're at gross weight, and you have everything against you. And you have to do the same thing with that. You have to transition back to that glide to get a glide ratio, a certain descent rate, so you don't split the bottom of the aircraft, you know, plus the people. So it's sort of a sad transition. And I don't want it to make sound bad that aviation is all a case of crashing and dying. What I'm saying is that when something happens, it happens when you least expect it to happen. So you have to have a lot of training, and I emphasize training at all times. The guy who just got his private ticket is probably the most proficient pilot right then. 6 months later, when he's taking his girlfriend for a ride and his best buddies for a ride, he's not very proficient anymore, because he's not out practicing. So he takes his buddy and they go for a ride. He comes back and he bounced the landing. And the guy says, gee, you bounced. He says, oh yeah, I do that all the time. He's not going to admit that's not the way you do it. But he's slowly losing his edge as a proficient pilot. And what he should be doing is either going back to an instructor or practicing what he was taught so he becomes a better pilot. You see, somewhere along they get lackadaisical and just say, that's good enough, I got it down. And then he goes to be a commercial pilot and he gets retrained. And the day he gets out of that commercial pilot school with his new certificate in his pocket, he is the most proficient pilot going. And unless he fulfills that proficiency by flying regular, and he probably will as an airline pilot, but how much does he get to fly in the co-pilot seat? He doesn't get that much time. All he has to do is pass his little checks every so often. And he passes them within the tolerance of whoever the examiner is. So the proficiency goes downhill a little bit. So you have to stay after it at all times. There's people I know that have been flying for a lot of years. One of my instructors was a fellow in Connecticut there that he had flown during the war. And my last trip back east a year ago, I ran into him. He's retired from flying now. He's 77. He had over 40,000 hours of flight time. And he still talks aviation today. That's his life. And I'm sure if you went up with him tomorrow, he wouldn't be as proficient as anybody else either. But it wouldn't take him long to get back to it. So I think, you know, pilots have to continue training. And if they don't, then they might as well get their own little airplane and fly around for the pleasure of it and get out of the airline business.
How many plane crashes have we had in Kodiak, say, in the last 10 years?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. You say in Kodiak, I mean, there's a list a mile long of people that aren't here anymore. Hal Derrick was my friend. He went down. That was weather-related. Another area of a lot of accidents is fish spotting. You know, you lost Greg Curley in that. And other ones that weren't from this area but crashed here. That one of the cannons went down here too, I believe. Paul Bucher was strictly air taxi pilot when he went in. Robbie Hall, we never found him or the airplane. We found some of the people that were in it. And that was weather related. Dark night, low ceilings, coming back on a scheduled air charter run. So I think you're going to find out weather is still the most prominent thing. but we've lost an awful lot of people. And you can back up and say, why did we lose them? We can tell you why we lost them. But how can we get around it? It's just education and training again. And it's people who in their own mind have to say, this is not the weather. I should be out there carrying passengers for a living. I should stay home. And if the boss fires me, then I'll look for another job. But most people went because there was pressure from the management that said, well, we got to get those people out of there. We got to get the airplane back tonight. And that's what hurt us.
Do you think herring spotters should have any extra or special training before they are able to go out on that kind of work?
I think personally the FAA ought to develop a course for, how would you say it, defensive flying for herring spotters and fish spotters. And I think the other rule of that they agreed to a long time ago, which was just in writing, and all the pilots agreed, was to carry an observer. And the problem we've got is now they're not carrying observers anymore. And the few that are, you'll find out the observer's looking for fish just like the pilot is. And you got to break him of that habit and say, hey, your job is to watch for other airplanes. My job is to do this. Or if you're the pilot, say, I'll fly, you watch for the fish, I'll watch for the other people. But, you know, we've lost a lot of people doing that. And next year we'll say, okay, we're going to get an agreement together. The FAA's coming down. We're all going to agree that we're going to fly the patterns this way and that we're all going to have an observer. And the observer's job is to watch out for the other aircraft. And we're still going to have accidents because the guy that goes down will only be one person in the plane. And this happens every year. Some years we've been lucky, we haven't lost anybody. But 9 out of 10, we're going to lose somebody. And it's all because that if you take an observer, you guarantee him a percentage of the fish spot, the revenues. If you don't take an observer, that other percent or 2% or whatever you were thinking about is in your pocket. And people become greedy like anything else. You know, why should I ask him that? To help carry the apples when I can carry the whole basket myself and have them all. And that's what they're doing. There are some people that still fly with an observer, and they're still here.
I heard a story shortly after I got to Kodiak about, I think it was Kodiak Airways flying back from someplace with a anesthetized bear in the back that woke up. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I remember the story. I'm not sure what happened with the bear. I know that they had a bear that fishing game was involved, and they had tranquilized this bear, and it was coming back with a Grumman goose somewhere over around, I'm going to say Geographic Harbor or Geographic Bay, whatever they call it over there. And the story I got was that the bear started to sort of come back to life, and because of this, it was decided to land the aircraft. Well, it was pretty stormy that day, and when they landed it, the Grumman flipped over. And the story I have is that they all got out of the plane and got ashore because they weren't far from the beach. And the survival gear was in the tail end of the goose, and the goose tail did come within probably 50 feet of the beach. But nobody wanted to go out and grab this big canister, which had a tent and fire starting equipment and space blankets and you name it, because they were afraid this bear was magically going to swim out of this airplane. So they got ashore, and they even cut off the tubes off the life jackets so they could get a steady stream of air on this fire they were trying to build that they never quite got built. And once everybody realized the plane was missing, they sent out a search party and they found them. And luckily, because one of the fishing game biologist was pretty well into hypothermia, and another day he wouldn't have survived. But after it was all done and the stories of the bear and all that, when they went out to the aircraft, the bear was still inside the airplane. He had drowned at that point. But it sort of makes you wonder what the theory was. If you have the bear in there and he's tied down with a cargo net, and he's strong, he could break that cargo net, and you have these fishing game people there who are qualified to issue, you know, give these drugs to these animals, you think maybe there was another way they could have gave him another shot of some kind, and continued on home. But who's ever going to doubt the fact that the bear was waking up? You know, I mean, that's the story I was told, and I wasn't there. So who are you gonna believe?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had, I remember another one right after that that he brought in the Kodiak because it was going to be displaced from some other part of the island to another part, and they came in the Kodiak for fuel. And the bear was in the back part of the airplane, a big brown bear, all tranquilized, laying there. And the pilot that pulled up to the gas pumps told us one kid up there, he wanted to top off because he was going to another place to, and they were going to get rid of this bear. And the pilot's dog came out, who said, "Gee, there's my master." And he hopped up in the Grumman. And it's probably the only dog anybody ever saw that turned around in midair and came back out. Because once he saw that bear, he wanted nothing to do with the airplane. But they were moved that way for years. Tranquilize them, you know, put them in the airplane and take them someplace else.
Seems like it'd be pretty a lot of hard work just to get the bear in and out of the airplane.
It's terrible because they're so heavy. You always hope it's a younger bear so they're not so heavy. But once in a while you're stuck. You know, you got to get that big one in there. But with the doors, the hatch is the way to work. If you're right next to the beach, it's not too bad if you have enough people. You know, there's enough to do there. It's not been one of my ideas to ever carry around tranquilized bears in any airplane. I'm not always sure that drug's going to last, or if you're flying by yourself or somebody taps you on the shoulder, it could be pretty scary.
Does the FAA require a certain amount of survival gear to be in a bush plane? And if they don't require it, should they?
Well, they do. And it's actually law. It's part of the Alaska Supplement, which is a supplement to all the flying. And in there, it lists the minimum survival equipment that you will carry for two periods, during the winter and then in the winter, I should say fall and winter, and then spring and summer. They're just a little bit different because you don't need, how about in the summer, you probably don't need the big wool blankets that you would need in the wintertime. You wouldn't need the snowshoes. But it's a pretty comprehensive list. The FAA does require it. All the air carriers have to have it. But there's exceptions. We'll take a Boeing 737. They couldn't carry enough equipment to take care of 100 people. But see, they're always within range of an airport, you know. And the chances of them having a failure is pretty slight. But the smaller planes, like the flying club here on the base, we have to carry the survival equipment because it's law. And we carry everything except what a person has to carry. For instance, in the winter, his pistol, snowshoes, and blankets, they're responsible for them. But we're responsible for the rest. And there's certainly enough training in it. The air taxi operators have to have it. It certainly has saved people by having it aboard. I think it could be improved. But on a day like today, I don't care how much survival equipment you got. If you're going to take off in this mess legally, you might as well have stayed on the ground. It's foolish to take off in this. If I was a big 737 out here and I could see the runway and know that an hour from now I'd be in Anchorage, and the possibility of that 737 losing both engines is so slight, I probably wouldn't have a real qualm with it. But the average air taxi shouldn't be taking off today. It's foolish.
I'll stop.
Oh, the rocket launch facility?
Yes.
I don't think that's a bad idea. My only heartbreak with it is we're talking rockets, and I don't even have a problem with rockets and rocket fuel. What I'm worried about is the debris that could come from rocket launching. You know, there's a certain amount of debris, stages that fall off and this and that. There's a liquid propellant involved in this stuff too. And I'd be more interested in the proper storage of it and the burn stage of it and how much is left when it gets to where it's going, and how much garbage is going to fall off that rocket before it gets where it's going. And who's going to clean it up? You know, for years we've thrown everything in the dump, nobody cared. Now we're sort of interested in why the dumps are full. So, and then I guess I'm sort of worried about the animals and the environment and everything else. Is that going to be fatal to them, you know, with this liquid propellant? That's what I'm worried about. You know, it's not a bad adventure to do all this tracking and take all these pictures and do all this other stuff. But I'd like to make sure that we're going to keep the environment good in the whole deal. And I'm not sure that Kodiak's a place, but it's so barren out there, I'm not too much against that.
They're going to put that in at the old tracking station?
No, it's supposed to go at Narrow Cape.
Oh.
Yeah, Narrow Cape, which is less stuff there. You had the Coast Guard communication station there, but yeah, they were going to put it in Chiniac, and they were going to make it downrange from Cape Greville, where I had a cabin up there, and that'd be all right, but that's sure going to stir up the woods. You know, there's a lot of animals up in there, and I worry about all the junk that falls off and all the propellants they're using, and what does that eventually do to the ecosystem of the world? You know, we're still taking rusted tanks and underground tanks and old barrels and everything else from World War II out of there, and Quonset huts and barrels that have just, you know, laid there for 50 years. And I'd like to see it cleaned up and let it go back to what it should be, make some greenery instead of just a mess of something else we got to clean up. And the government should be responsible for it. And I don't know what they're doing with this deal. I'm not sure we need it, I guess. But if it boosts the economy, that's one thing. But if they bring in 30 technicians from the outside, that doesn't boost our economy. You know, might put a few dollars in town.
Mm-hmm, at the motels.
At the motels or at the grocery store. But that's about it. It's not going to benefit the people of Kodiak. You know, we want to benefit the people of Kodiak, but something here they all work at. I think the prison system was the best deal. They were going to put a prison out there in Chiniac, where the tracking station was.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would hire 30 or 40 guards locally. And then you'd have, you know, dining room people and stuff like that. And that would have boosted the economy. But this thing's not going to do anything, just a couple of people. I don't believe it's going to help us at all. Except put our name on the map someplace. And everybody knows where Kodiak is by now.
Yeah, they even know where Old Harbor is now.
That's right. That's right. And every other village.
Is there anything else that you'd like to mention or add that you've thought about, or about how aviation here in Kodiak or Alaska might be changing? Or,
well, I think it's changing some, but I think it's changing for the good. I think you know, each generation pilots come, you get maybe a little bit people that are more interested in aviation, that are willing to study more, become more proficient. Kodiak's still flying, I shouldn't say behind the times, but we're still flying with old equipment, you know, the Grummans and that, and of course they've been very dependable all these years. But I think Kodiak overall has a good selection of pilots right now, and I think they're interested. We had a safety seminar the other night at the college, and a couple people from Anchorage came down, Tom Wardley, who's the Alaska Safety Foundation, and Ted Marcinek, I'm going to say his name is, from Northern Avionics, talking about this new GPS global positioning system with this little radio in your airplane. And it was quite interesting, and I think it's all a movement. And the amazing thing about it was that as much education as the pilots have in this area, we had pilots from every outfit on Kodiak that attended the safety seminar. I mean, even the air taxi boys. And the place was packed. So there is interest in it, and I think we've got a better breed of pilots now. But they're interested in saying, hey, what is new? Safety-wise, what can we do to improve it? And we've been real lucky here that for a long time we haven't had any accidents, no, nothing major. You know, a few fender benders here and there, but that's about it. So I think we're improving. I just hope it continues.
The pilots certainly seem to be getting younger.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that's...
As we get older, they look younger.
Right, right. I know the other year when I went to the lake to go moose hunting, I looked at that pilot and I said, boy, is this guy old enough to have a certificate? But I guess he was. Yeah, you sort of wonder because you're getting older and they seem to be just starting. So I don't know if a guy, if the pilot got on and had his cane and that, I'd probably be a little bit more nervous than if he was young. We got a pretty good group right now. Seems like a real safe bunch. And I've been real happy with them.
Well, I've always felt that the pilots wanted to get home in one piece just as much as I did.
Yes, yes. And most of them will not push the weather. Now, when I go with them, even down to the lake, and I don't care whether it's a well-experienced pilot or a younger pilot, but being at Kodiak as long as I've been, they know who I am. And I think in a way, it stops them from taking any chances. They say, geez, if I go there, that pass is partially fogged. I wonder what this guy's going to say. And they think, gee, now, see, now he's one of the accident prevention counselors. And, geez, he's this and he's that. And the best way would be to go here. So I better go that way. So it helps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I get unhappy with what I see, I usually ask the pilot, why are we going this way? Is it shorter? And it helps because a lot of times they'll say, well, I was thinking we'd do this. And then you can honestly get a conversation out that leads to a safe flight all the way back. Because I'm not there because I'm smarter than they are. I mean, my only job as a counselor is to say, are we doing the right thing? What would happen if the guy said, well, I don't care what you say, I'm going this way? Well, I don't know. I never had that experience. I don't know if I'd go to a fist fight or not at that point.
Why don't the pilots of Kodiak just fly over all the mountains? I didn't think they were that high.
Well, the problem is that with the weather, a lot of times the clouds are at the mountain tops. So you go through the valleys, mm-hmm. which is perfectly legal because they only have to maintain a certain distance from everything. Yeah, I agree on a as we call a bluebird day, it's great to fly over the top, you know, and see all the land you missed for a month. But it's not required. They have rules as to how much height and clearance they have to have from everything, which is a little bit less than, say, the average pilot has. But it doesn't seem to hurt us. We haven't had any accidents because of it. So it's just different rules. They're allowed lower minimums than other people are. And actually, to be honest with you, they're not taking any chances. They don't feel that they couldn't come out. I've watched this local one here, and I don't know. Except for the wind, there's days I would have said, I'm not leaving. But they seem to fly well, and their accident record is really, I might as well say, perfect. Because they're not having the accidents. And they all seem to be good, conscious pilots, so I'd fly with them. Yeah, I don't have much problem with these guys here. Maybe it's because it's near home, but you know the people here personally. Whereas if you go to, say, Anchorage and you flew out to the bush to caribou hunt or something, you wouldn't know that pilot personally.
Mm-hmm.
You'd probably be real skeptical of what he was doing. But here, you know, we know the area and we know where we're going, and so we're a lot happier with them. So the most that can happen there is a mechanical problem, and that can happen to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like driving down the street and the engine quits, you don't know why, but The only difference is you're still on the street.
Yeah.
But I think aviation is coming along. I like to see some of these big programs, as I said before. All these electrical and monstrous systems in this airplane, a little more simplified. Because I think if you simplify them, you'd have less problems with them. And I don't think we've had some of these big, scary accidents we had over the last 6 months, where you dump 100 and some people because of some little item that went wrong. Doesn't make much sense, to me anyway.
Yeah, I've always thought that the 737 was one of the safest and most comfortable planes I've ever been in.
Oh yeah.
And yet it seems like all of a sudden they're starting to fall out of the sky.
Yeah, they are safe, but it's just these little things. Things that normally would not happen. And suddenly they are. So now the question is, you got to get down and find out why. You know, who would... We're running 737-400s in the Kodiak now, and they seem to have a good record. But the old 200 probably had the best record of anybody. And now suddenly they're having problems. So you don't know. Technology.
I wonder if airplane manufacturers are actually as technologically advanced as they think they are.
Well, system-wise, they are. And, you know, system-wise, it has to be approved by the feds. And the feds are approving them, and they're testing them and saying, hey, these are going to work, and these will work with the limits that they set. And then you get up there in that freak snowstorm or electrical storm, and something triggers a system that shouldn't have been triggered. Maybe it's an outside influence that did it. Certainly, I don't think it was an inside influence. But maybe an outside influence. Maybe it's an electrical current being generated outside there in a storm that kicks off one of these little sensors. We don't know that. And the problem starts, and you can't correct the problem. So now all you can do is go back and correct the problem as far as, if this happens, we don't want the plane to roll over and do this. We want the plane to have some safeguard that senses that that's what might happen and stops. And there's where you're back to. I don't know how else you can do it. You know, every plane should be 100% safe, but they're not. And sometimes it's technology, and other times it's human.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really know. I wish I knew. But, you know, next month they'll probably say, oh, well, here's what happened, and the reason it happened is this. And then we'll have another bunch of rules to stop that. And, but I like it to the point that all these problems they have can't go into a system that becomes so critical that it causes the airplane to crash. You know, something lights a bell up and says, hey, discontinue that system. You know, and there's all kinds of safeguards out there. But when something deploys that shouldn't, then you have a problem. I mean, if one side wing slats deploy and the other side don't, it's going to roll. No risk to it. And you got to have something to go bang that stops that before it goes. But it's fast. It's so fast. So I don't know. I wish I could come up with an answer for it. But I don't know. I don't think we're getting unsafe, but I think we're getting... technical problems we need to solve to become unsafe, you know, to get rid of the unsafe part of it, so that if this problem occurs, we can go, that gets rid of that system, so we're back to a safe flight. That's what we got to do, and I don't know when that's going to be. Maybe this year, maybe the year 2000, for all I know. I can't think of anything else.
Well, that's all the questions I had for you.
Now you can put that into your time capsule and